So please feel free to interrupt here. Presentation that I have in mind is really kind of at the level of this review paper that I did 15 years ago now that I think quite a few people have seen. And so for you to get anything out of this, it'll require some feedback from you and input that we can move a little deeper into some things, and if I can't answer, maybe Bob can or other people in the room here or something. So anyway, the title that I had in mind for this was actually neutral models in the coalescent process, and we've already touched on some of the issues I wanted to get to in my little bit of introduction about this before I get to the coalescent model part of things. But so you'll see that in a second. I was really kind of interested in laying out this idea of distribution of selective effects and what these different models are. But so the way I kind of wanted to start was to describe what I think the data are that we'll be interested in trying to interpret and use in some way. And the data will come in many different forms and have many different issues. So this is this one particular simple view of it that I think kind of orients a little bit the kind of things we might talk about. So the data I'm thinking of is what I'd call a resequencing study. So you have some long sequence that you've obtained from some particular region of the genome, and then you've resequenced the same region from another individual, another individual, another individual, another individual. So your data consists of the sequence of this homologous region from these set of individuals. Okay, and these sequences obviously are this standard DNA sequences, four-letter alphabet kind of thing, and I'm going to imagine that we don't have insertion and deletion polymorphism, and so that's something we don't have to worry about. So they're just straight simple sequences, and you can align them all like this. So does everybody know what I mean when I say homologous sequence with that, what I'm referring to there? So this is not like a sequence from chromosome 1, and this is a sequence from chromosome 5, and they're all supposed to be from the same place in the genome and be kind of different copies of the same part of the genome.
I ask something? So does it matter if you have errors in your sequence?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think...
Is there any way of allowing for...
Definitely, certain kinds. But I think it's a huge issue these days. And it's one, when we were talking about these other issues of evolutionary questions and stuff, sort of a technical issue about analyzing data is incorporating error rates is big. And I'm not going to talk about it today, but there are ways of dealing with it, yeah.
As long as we've interrupted you, you said that this will be from a review paper. Can you give us some citations?
It's a little hard to find, but you can actually get it at my website. There's a PDF of it, and it appeared in Oxford Surveys in Evolutionary Biology, I think it was. And it's about 1991. Anyway, like you say, if you... So there's a PDF you can get, as I say, on my website. The other thing, as long as we're on references and stuff, so there's quite a few other reviews more recently that have come out over the last 10 years, so that's old. And there's a very nice new book that John Wakely has just come out this year that's a great survey, and it's much more in-depth and has much more of the mathematical details than you'll get in that review. So I highly recommend this as an introduction. John Wakely is the author. Okay, so the data is sort of like this, and if I thought about just focusing on the first two sequences, and these are lined up for any organism, they'd sort of match at most sites, so they'd have the same. If this was an A here, at that same position, you'd have an A there, et cetera. And then occasionally you'd find some site where this sequence differed from that. In humans, that's about maybe 1 out of 1,000 base pairs you'd find that kind of difference. In flies, it's more like 1 out of 100. So you'd go along in this comparison and you'd find places where they differed. And when you compare the rest of them, you find maybe this one has the same one as that one, is different than that. Anyway, you'd find these sites that I'm going to indicate with these X's that are where there's variation at a particular position. And so the data that I'm talking about is basically, I'm really going to be focusing on models where there's only two variants at any site. So there are generalizations that, realistically, there can be three or four, all four nucleotides at a site, although that's unusual. But for a lot of analyses, we use what's called an infinite site model, and in those models, there's only two types at any one site. Most sites, there's only one allele. But at the sites like where I've indicated the X's, there's just two alleles. So you can actually think of coding the data by just actually coding mutants, and I'll say what I mean by that, by one, and the non-mutants by zero. And the data is just basically sets of ones and zeros like this. And you record maybe the positions, but then all the other things you sort of drop out. So the data starts to look like, you know, 1, 1, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, 1, et cetera. And you record the positions of these, and everything else drops away. And that's your data. That's the data that I'm talking about, sort of an idealized data set. It's just these strings of ones and zeros indicating this pattern of polymorphism in a sample of sequences. And
so empirically, how often does one see a third allele?
A third allele? In I was trying to think of a number for humans, but I think it's more or less one in a thousand sites is polymorphic. I think it roughly looks like, you know, multiplying by another factor of 1,000, yeah, one in a million. It's somewhat higher than that because there's heterogeneity in mutation rates. So there's cold spots and hot spots, and so it is higher than that. But
depends how big the sample.
And depends how big the sample is, for sure.
It depends whether you're in mitochondrial DNA or in nucleated.
Yep, that's right. Mitochondrial DNA has another issue of, even though you only see two, it might be that there's lots of mutation, and so that there's the same allele has been created several times by mutation from the other one. And the kind of analysis I'll mostly talk about kind of assumes, like I said, the mutation rate at individual sites is so low that you only get two of these alleles. But it's just sort of a convenient, simpler model to analyze. It's not one that really gets, that we can, in principle, overcome by just doing numerical stuff or something. But it is a little bit of an issue because people analyze the data and then they'll throw out sites and they'll do various things to clean it up to make it match with this model to do their analysis. So in practical terms, maybe it is serious. I'm happy to go with this model, and I happily proceed with this kind of infinite site model.
Is the zero assigned to the majority
arc? Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that. So the way I'm going to use it, I'm going to assume I can actually tell which is a mutant form and which is not, and it doesn't necessarily follow which is the most common one. And the way in practice that's typically done is you have these set of sequences, say, from humans, and then you have a sequence of chimpanzees, say, and you compare that and you say, well, most likely in this chimpanzee-human data set, there's only one mutation here. If there's polymorphism here, then the state in the chimp is what was the ancestral state. But there's an error rate to that inference as well. But I'm going to assume I actually know that for most of what I talk about. It simplifies some of the things. So these are actually, if there was no recombination for this whole region we're talking about, then we think that there's a genealogical tree that represents the history of these, and I'm going to get much, much more into that. But that if that tree, you know, for these set of sequences look like that, where this is the past and this is where we've sampled these sequences, each of these polymorphic sites in here represents a place where there's a mutation on this genealogy, and all the descendants of those have ones at that site, and the ones that aren't descended from that have the zeros. So I'm assuming I can identify what the state was at the root back here. So that answer your question?
Yes. Okay.
Now, the size of this data set in both this direction and this direction can often be important in how you sort of treat it and think about it, especially in terms of recombination and things. But so Marty talked yesterday about his work as a graduate student doing a resequencing study of this type in Drosophila, and he had 11 copies of the gene that were sequenced, I think. and it was roughly 3,000 base pairs long. And that was a landmark study at the time to get polymorphism data. Where today, it won't be long before in humans we have 1,000 in this direction and whole genomes, 3 × 10⁹ base pairs in that direction, essentially. But it'll be different it'll be all the chromosomes. So today I was going to focus primarily on models without any recombination in them. And so then you're either sort of thinking of mitochondria or you're thinking of pretty short segments here. And in fact, you're really thinking about a fantasy land. I mean, it almost, and if you're not talking about mitochondria, there just aren't regions without recombination. And
the Y chromosome.
The Y chromosome. Yeah, absolutely right. But a lot of people still analyze even autosomal genes with models without recombination, at least as a starting point. But it's acknowledged that you can't, that you run into problems right away in doing that, that you're making an error in doing that. So anyway, so you've got this data set that's basically these strings of ones and zeros. And what you'd like to do is from that make inferences about a bunch of things. And I wanted to make this little short list. So you might make inferences about genetic parameters. So that would be mutation, recombination, although like I said, the models, when I get to talking about specific kinds of models or sort of results today, it's going to be without recombination. And there could be other, depending on the organism and et cetera, there might be insertion. You might want to subdivide these mutation rates into different kinds of mutation rates. You might be interested in estimating gene conversion as well as sort of standard crossing over kind of mutation rate. Anyway, genetic parameters. Then you might be interested in making inferences about demographic parameters. So under a simple sort of model, you might have a constant population size through time, and you might want to estimate that. Now, it'll turn out in a lot of the models you can estimate a compound parameter involving these two, but not separate them. But that might, that population size might vary in time, and you might want to be able to make an inference about that. You might have some sort of geographic structure, spatial structure, so you have different subpopulations. And so each one of those populations may have a history of its population size that's different. And then in that case, you also have migration parameters between all the subpopulations that you might want to make inferences about. And those might vary in time. And then there are splits between populations. Populations split off and send off a founder group. So split times, et cetera, you might want to estimate. So the whole kind of historical pattern of movement and population size you might want to get. And then there's all the sort of selection parameters that we've alluded to already that you might want to be able to make inferences about, and that includes things like making inferences about the distribution of selection of effects that we've talked about, but also how selection might, so if this is kind of a selection coefficient that measures how a new mutant differs in fitness from the parental copy, that may have a temporal and a spatial sort of component to it as well. So ultimately, I mean, this is an outline I made last night, and you can see how it ties into a lot of what we already talked about this morning. So what I'm really going to be talking about is sort of the simplest possible demographic model, simplest possible sort of genetic situation. So I'm even going to assume that this recombination rate is zero and describe a little bit about what we know about this kind of pattern of polymorphism in samples that we get. And I wanted to, I had a little segment about neutral models that I was going to say something about before I got into this precise model, and I guess I will say that. As you all know, neutral models are sort of these models in which the variants don't have an effect on the fitness of those who bear them. In particular, things like the distribution of the number of offspring an individual would have doesn't depend on which particular alleles it carries, what its genotype is. What I wanted to emphasize, and this is not a deep concept, but the sort of typical, there used to be more so than there is now this sort of schools of population geneticists, and there were neutralists and selectionists and that. And the sort of standard view of a neutral model was not that all variation was selectively neutral, but that all variation was either selectively neutral or quite strongly deleterious. So, yeah.
Well, sorry, I wanted to clarify terms. So you, by inferences, you mean learning of parameters, right? So you're not discussing inferring concrete sequence. I mean, sequences.
I'm not talking about inferring sequences
And you're not, well, it's like...
Or reconstructing historically what the sequences were. That's correct. I'm not.
You're not.
I'm not. I'm talking about really sort of parameters that go in a population genetic model to describe the, you know, how a population evolves.
Can I ask why you're not interested in history?
I think there are many interesting problems there, and I might talk about a few particular ones, but so I guess my perspective is one where the details of what the sequences were in these places and what the times of these nodes are sort of random realizations of a process maybe it's just sort of a personal choice. I'm really sort of focused on what's this evolutionary process that's been going on in this population all through this time, and the actual precise values of these realized stochastic events I thought of as somewhat secondary. But there's absolutely a bunch of interesting questions about, you know, the history of human populations where particular nodes on here have very important relevance to a bunch of other questions about just the history of humans. And there's also cases where people are making inference of selection on some particular site, you know, that there was on this polymorphism there was some kind of selection, or even a site that's not polymorphic here, maybe recently fixed by selection. And they're interested in making an inference about when that mutation arose and when that selection started. And so particular nodes on this tree are of interest to make an inference about. And they'll relate it then to what's known about human history and culture. And so, for example, people think that when agriculture became a common mode in humans, that changed things like maybe malaria was more prevalent because people lived in denser communities, and I don't know. There's a lot of cultural and historical things that tie into what might have been changes in selection, and just changes in diet when we moved into certain zones. Estimating times of this might be very relevant to interpreting those things. But maybe you have some other...
So is it fair to say that one isn't asking questions about ancestral sequence because answers cannot be falsified?
No, so I'll be talking tomorrow about some ancestral inference kind of ideas and how you might do the analysis and various things like that. So, yeah, you're definitely here. At least in a math sense.
So did you want to expand on what you're thinking of?
Maybe another question along this line. This mutation rate or recombination rate or whatnot. You're talking about some average values or distributions. So we will be discussing just one, original set of what we call snapshot of different individuals, and then have ensemble of those snapshots.
I'm not sure I got your question. I for the most part, I'll be assuming things like mutation rate to stay constant over time. I'll be assuming for the most part mutation is sort of uniform on here, although it's fairly easy to generalize beyond that. So my having said that, maybe you could state your question again. Then I.
So you draw this,
these set of data here.
Thousand of samples.
Right.
And then I can imagine, having another thousand of, samples like that. And,
yeah.
But treating them separately, right?
And right.
Doing this reconstruction business for each of those sets.
Yeah.
And then, having a distribution.
Yeah.
Mutation, right, as an outcome.
Right.
So alternatively, presumably, predict the mutation rate in the sense of maximum likelihood.
Right. So maximum likelihood would be one example.
Yeah.
But yeah, we can do distribution as well, right?
So what I will be assuming for parameters, as a first pass, I'll assume these kind of parameters. There's some unknown but true fixed value of those parameters. And you'll be trying to make an inference about what that is. Now, your inference will have uncertainty in it. And so if you're using a Bayesian scheme or something, you'll end up with some posterior distribution what that is. If you take another sample of 1,000 out of this population, you would hope that posterior distribution you got out of that overlapped heavily with the other one. And in fact, what you typically want to do is do an analysis that combined the two. It's not the case. So it will not be the case in what I'm talking about that one actually makes explicitly an inference about each of these times and reconstructs this tree. The tree will be sort of a tool for arriving at results of what we think the observed patterns are here. And we'll make an inference that's more directly tied to this and which would incorporate all the uncertainty of what this actual history was for this sample, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Let me ask one more related question.
Yeah.
So right now you seem to be saying you don't really care what's a one and what's a zero. On the other hand, originally you were saying you don't care what the ancestral sequence is.
Oh.
And yet originally you were saying the ones were the mutations.
Yeah. So what I meant was, so actually, if there's no recombination, we have an infinite site model, we actually can construct what these are without any error. The times at which they occurred is something we can't precisely say. Now, actually, with more realistic models, we can't without error infer what these ancestral states are. But so what I meant was, I was assuming that I could make this inference correctly of ones and zeros here. And in fact, I do know what these states are back in here. And it's not that I don't care about them. It's just not the focus of my interest are making inferences about these parameters. But distinguishing a little bit is there are people who the first thing they do is reconstruct this tree. And they will present you with that tree. And then they'll actually try and make an inference about parameters from kind of their inferred tree structure, and that's not sort of the flavor of the way I'm going about things. But so did that make sense? Okay. Maybe before I get back to my neutral model, I'll say just a couple other things about one other thing about this kind of data. It's common that when data like this comes from humans, especially and a lot of other organisms now, that if we're talking about autosomal genes, the part of the genome where there's two copies of everything in each individual, these things come kind of in pairs that represent the data coming from a single diploid individual. And it's often the case that the way the data is collected, you actually can't tell whether this mutant allele is on this chromosome or that chromosome. So there's this uncertainty of phase. They call it unphased data. And a lot of inference methodologies now have to face that uncertainty. And an earlier theory had been done where one assumed one knew all the phases of everything, and now there's this additional kind of uncertainty. But there are methods for dealing with that in a variety of ways, but it's oftentimes technically an additional challenge. And what's been brought up earlier, error rates in this stuff, I think are quite important, become more and more important all the time. The other thing is that this data may have locality associated with it. So these may have been sampled from one locality, Western Europe or something, and these may have been sampled from East Asia or something. And so there's the data can get as much more complicated as.
Can I just quickly ask
sure.
about that base thing?
Yeah.
Is that because both strands or both variants are sequenced at the same time?
Yeah, I think that's right.
So you get sort of multiple peaks.
That's right.
You
yeah.
don't know the,
exactly.
It's both copies of the chromosome.
Right. So if you have two mutations, you don't know.
That's right. If you only have one, you're fine. That's exactly.
Okay.
That's right. So that's exactly. You don't know whether it's like this or like this.
So my understanding of this, perhaps Chris can tell me as a sort of biology person, is that you can actually sort of out biology, it's just expensive to actually work out which one's on which. Is that right?
Yes, that in principle...
You can do it.
You could yeah. use molecular methods to sort out what the phase was, but it's so prohibitively laborious and expensive that no one does it. Yeah.
Another way in which it's done actually is you do three individuals... You do two parents and an offspring, and then you can often infer with a fair amount of reliability, not 100%, but what the parental chromosomes must have been. So if you have this kind of unphased information for two parents and an offspring, you can often infer this.
I mean, it's generally not, I think, thought to be such a severe problem. When you have a sample of those diploid individuals for that region, some of those individuals will be homozygotes for the whole region. And so then you know a haplotype. And then you can ask whether other individuals could be combinations of those known ones. And by this various kind of bootstrapping procedure, there's good computational methods for inferring haplotypes. And in general, that alone works reasonably well if you have some additional trio data and things like that.
Yeah.
In reality, for the human data, they think they can sort it out quite well, right?
Yeah, I think there's quite a few algorithms now that people have developed to try and infer these things. I think that's right. Although I'm not completely, when I've talked to people who really are dealing with the data and they for certain kinds of analyses where haplotypes are important, I think they often run into problems where the algorithms they think have really failed, and they go back and they talk to the ones and they say, oh yeah, well there's lots of like labeling problems. And anyway, I think I'm not completely convinced that there aren't a lot of analyses that actually get screwed up because there are problems with this that we don't entirely haven't acknowledged completely yet. But for the most part, people just pipe the stuff through a program and they get it out phased and they happily march along. Okay, so the one thing I wanted to say about neutral models is that if I represent the total spontaneous mutation rate for some region like this by this, the parameter that a sort of neutralist would typically want to introduce is something like the fraction of all of spontaneous mutations that are neutral. And the typical... If you want to analyze it in a neutral context, basically what we assume is all the rest are strongly deleterious. And that's sort of the standard neutral model. So this quantity F is something that might vary from one region of the genome to another, or one class of sites to another, and it accounts for the fact that the rate of evolution in different regions can be very different. And so mutation rates also can, of course, vary. So under a neutral sort of view of thing, if one's trying to fit a neutral model, you have this extra degree of freedom that you're typically allowing yourself. And these strongly deleterious things are assumed to be so strongly deleterious that any small sample like this, those mutations would be so rare you wouldn't see them in this. And when you look between species, those things have never accumulated. So all the patterns of variation within and between species are a consequence of this mutation rate F times U of T, the fraction that are neutral. And this F, or 1 minus F, is some kind of a measure of the constraint that operates in a region. So neutralists are happy to acknowledge that there's negative selection. We call this selection against all these mutants that are strongly deleterious that are very quickly weeded out of the population. I refer to that as selective constraint. And so I just wanted to make sure that people didn't think that neutral models meant that you felt that every single site and every single mutant everywhere across the region is absolutely has no functional effect. In fact, it's implicit. Most people thinking about it, there are many that are deleterious. It's just that everything that's polymorphic here is a site where the variation is selectively neutral, and things. So the pattern of variation here is not affected by this, except for in the way that this total neutral mutation rate gets reduced by this factor F. Now, it turns out that lots of deleterious mutations happen in this region. We learned in the last 10 or 15 years actually can have more of an important effect on the neutral variation here than we originally sort of perceived, and especially where you have large regions with very little recombination, it turns out that this deleterious part can have some impact. But maybe next week I could talk about that a little more. But for the most part, in the models I'll be talking about, it'll be as if this just doesn't exist and the total mutation rate is this, and all those mutations that come from this sort of rate parameter here are assumed to be neutral. Okay, so is that clear? So the spectrum of selective effects is in these neutral models is very special. Almost all of the mutations, or not almost all, some fraction of the mutations have no selective effect, and another fraction are like lethal or something. Or very, they don't have to be lethal, but just strongly deleterious. Okay, so that's the neutral model. Now let me actually get to what we wanted to get to, and that's population genetic models. So, so I wanted to introduce two distinct models, what's called the Wright-Fisher model and a Morin model. Is that the right way to say that, Morin?
Moran.
Okay, actually, okay. I would have said Moran, but I thought you're an Australian, you would know. Okay. I thought Warren always, Ewan's always said Morin, but. Okay. I'll call it Moran. It's easier. That's natural for me. Okay. So I wanted to. I won't talk much about this model. But I wanted to point out the kind of assumptions of this model, a contrast with this, just so you get a sense that there's a fair range of sort of possible ways you can do this. And it turns out these two models for the neutral model we're going to consider. For large population sizes, actually kind of converge to having the same kind of sample properties, even though the models seem somewhat different. But so anyway, I'll describe these two models sort of quickly, and then mostly stick with this model. So that's the way I usually do it. So Wright-Fisher models are discrete generation models. So there's unlike humans, there's a population of sort of a parental population. They reproduce and produce an offspring generation, and then that parental population you can sort of think of as dying, and then the offspring generation matures to a parent, to reproductive age, and then produces another. And so it's discrete generation that's crucial. And the other thing is that the usual way of thinking about how one generation is produced from the last is basically by some kind of sampling with replacement, and I'll expand on precisely what I mean by that in a second. But what that means is that, and for the to begin with at least, I'll think of the population size as being constant. But that's not any sort of a fundamental part of Wright-Fisher models, at least in my view. And so you can relax that. But it's easier to think about it first if it's constant. And so to produce an offspring generation, you sample copies of a gene enough times to produce the offspring, and you do that sampling with replacement. And so the result of that is that you get either, depending on how many kinds of alleles and stuff, that you get sort of multinomial distributions of most of the things that you're sort of interested in going from one generation to the next. So if you look at the number of copies of a particular kind of allele, something that you get these multinomial distributions because you're sampling with replacement to produce it. And I'll, let me be slightly more, draw a little picture to make sure this is very clear. So actually, I'm going to be thinking of diploid populations. And so this N here I'm going to use to represent the number of diploids sort of parental diploids. And each diploid will have two copies, so there'll actually be two N copies in the population of each gene. Now, it's just sort of historical. In a way, it would it'd be better just to do N copies of the gene, do everything in terms of N, because there's going to be these silly copies, factors of 2 and 4 that are going to appear everywhere, but it's the way I'm used to doing it, so I'm going to carry all those 2s and 4s around, and you'll just have to remember this N is the number of diploids, 2N is the number of copies, and so if you want to deal with a haploid organism that has population size N, you would want to replace this 2N by your N. Okay. So here's my little cartoon. Let me represent the population then as this, as with these set of lines. So this is a parental population, and so these are the copies that I've labeled from 1 to 2N. And in fact, in a diploid population, these things are sort of paired together. But the kind of analysis I'll do is really a haploid analysis, despite the fact that I have these 2s in there. And it turns out the diploid model for lots of things you'd be interested in behaves just like the haploid model, but just twice as many copies. So I'm really going to do the haploid model, but I'm going to have that 2 hanging around. Okay, so to produce the offspring population, I want to produce 2N copies of this gene, and I do it by just sampling at random and replicating and putting a copy there, picking at random again with replacement. Well, maybe it's this copy goes is replicated and put here, etc., until I'm all done, and I can resample 3 as a parent later on, so that's the with replacement business. And this replication, depending on what kind of analysis we want to do and what kind of model, may happen with mutation. And the kind of model I'll be thinking about is where a Poisson-distributed number of mutations is added, is sort of introduced with each replication event that produces an offspring. So if this mutation parameter is small, that's 0 or 1 mutations, and it's essentially a probability U that you get a mutation here and probably 1 minus U that you don't. But if you're considering a really huge region so that U is not very small, you might want to consider the possibility of multiple mutations. Okay, so that's the process. And as I say, if I'm thinking about this model I talked about before where I've got these are really represent fairly long sequences and the mutation rate is not too big, the way I would think about this process is when I introduce a mutation, it's given sort of a unique location along the segment of where it's assigned. So when that gets, if there's a mutation that happens there, it's assigned a location. When another mutation happens over here, it's randomly assigned a mutation. And for this model that I'm talking about, this infinite size model, I'll assume that those never hit the same spot as some other spot that's been hit earlier, so that they're, I think of them as just being on, you know, a continuous interval from 0 to 1 or something, or 0 to L, you know, length.
In this picture, some parents have multiple offspring and some have none.
Exactly, yeah. So if this population size is large, in fact, you expect something like e to the minus 1 of them, they have no offspring. So offspring numbers here, if this N is large, are very roughly Poisson distributed. And so, yeah, substantial proportion of the population has no descent. Now, if you don't have mutation, because of that kind of process, variation eventually decays away in the population. You have none left. But if you have mutation, every generation is introduced at some rate. You get some sort of a stationary, stochastic equilibrium. It's not a deterministic equilibrium, but it's a stochastic equilibrium of variation. So variation tends to decay as a consequence of the sampling process, but new variation is always introduced every generation by mutation. And so the idea here is you let this process go for a very long period of time, and then you sample a few sequences from the population, and that's the data set that I talked about there. And then you say you want to make inferences. And under this model, there's only two parameters, 2N and this mutation rate. If you've let this run for a very, very long time, there's no sort of, sort of an equilibrium situation. There's no time dependence from the starting state. And it turns out that all the properties of this sample with no recombination, no structure, this simple pattern. Everything depends on really just the product of this population size and mutation rate. So it really becomes kind of one parameter model. That's in the limit as this n is large, but where this product is finite. Yeah?
Sorry, when you said multinomial, I thought we were going to have a model in which there were, say, k possible genomes.
Yeah, that's...
When you said that mutations had locations, then I thought maybe every genome was sort of like a spin variable.
Well, so you're right. I was very loose in the way I was talking about it here. So what I meant was, yeah, if I had some finite number of types up here and I had no mutation, especially if I had no mutation, then the distributions would be multinomial here. But I was so sort of loose. And in this case, it's not appropriate to think of this as multinomial.
Okay, so every genome is either 0, 1, or it's along multiple...
I'm thinking of it as being a string like this.
Okay, so it's a multi-digit binary number.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. Thanks, because I was definitely loose there in web. Yeah. So, as I say, the idea is that each time you introduce a mutation, you get a 1 type allele that's at some particular location that you've assigned. And in this model, without recombination, the location is not informative about anything. It's just to distinguish it from other polymorphisms. And you could have given them any label you wanted, and they don't have to do with spatial location. If you introduce recombination, then the spatial location starts to be informative and relevant. But without recombination, it doesn't really matter what their positions are. Okay, so that's a Wright-Fisher model, and what I'll show you in a minute sort of how this parameter comes up, and we'll really get the coalescence stuff. But before I do that, let me describe briefly the Moran model. Now, it turns out there's some fairly broad classes of models that have very similar properties with just some kind of scaling factor that all kind of converge to sort of the same thing. And the Moran is one of them. So the way the Moran model works is you have these sort of a parental population again, and I'm going to assume a constant population size. And in this other case, this step was what we would call a generation, right? But in the Moran model, the time step really has to do with one individual replicating and one individual dying. So the time step is not a generation, and it's usually thought to be much shorter than a generation. So what you do in one time step is you pick 2 copies up here, but you do it with replacement. Now I'm going to draw it as if there were 2 distinct copies, but it'll be crucial that they actually, the 2 things that I've identified might be the same copy. And the first one that you pick, you kill. And the second one, you replicate to replace that one. So the next time step, this thing gets replicated and put here, but it also remains alive there. And this individual is, as I said, is killed. So in the case where you pick the same individual twice, you basically get like a replication. So you have the possibility of mutation. So it's sort of like an offspring. But you don't get, there's still in some sense, except for mutation, 1 copy of this type. Okay. So that's one possibility. And the other is that the picture looked like this, where you pick this twice, and then the result is that you get that with the possibility of mutation. And maybe I should put that up here. Okay. So that's all there is to the Moran model. And so it's very easy to get the probability of, if you had a model where you had a small number of types here and you had no mutation, probability that you got 1 extra copy of a particular allele or 1 less copy or the same number of copies of that allele in a time step are easy to write down. And so the transition probability of going from one parental, this population to this population are very easy to write down. And it turns out this model, actually there's a lot of theoretical results that you can get for this analytically and exactly that you can't get for this model. But it turns out in the limit of large populations, a lot of the behavior of this model is just like that model, except you have to figure out the correspondence between this time step here and the generation over there. And there's a lot of... but it's a fairly simple sort of changeover from one to the other. So this is an overlapping generation model, so there's no sort of changeover from one generation to the next. So you might think, well, roughly if you go 2n time steps, that on average every individual would have reproduced in that time. And that maybe that would correspond roughly to a generation in this model. And it turns out that that correspondence is usually made. That they sort of think of one generation being this. But the behavior of this model, in a lot of ways, that time, that conversion of that time doesn't exactly predict the properties on the that you get out of that other model. They don't correspond to that. You actually have to change the time scale. There's another factor, too, that comes in. So things like, for those where this means anything, the decay of, if you had a model without mutation and you looked at the rate at which variation was lost from the population, the rate at which it's lost per generation in this model, if you define generation by this 2n time steps, is not the same rate as that. But there's a factor of 2 involved.
So it's 4. So you have to do 4n.
Yeah, sort of. Yeah, that's right.
And so does every property have the same scaling with n?
Yeah, I think that's roughly true. Bob, would you say?
Well, time scaling is a different factor of n here.
Yeah.
In this model, sure. Not everything. So the mutation rate still scales.
Yeah.
N and so on. Just the time. Does the time scaling factor of n different?
Question.
Yeah.
So if you compare those two models from a point of view of distribution, stationary distribution which you are getting, but kind of different time correlations, different, right?
That's right. But there's a pretty simple transformation, a change of the time scale, which makes them look really just alike again.
I see. So it is those are the same not only from point of view of direct evolution, but also for reconstruction.
I think that's correct. I think that's correct. Yeah.
They're both in the domain of attraction of a diffusion process. So you get a sort of diffusion limit if you measured time in units of n generations here or time in units of
n squared.
Perhaps 2n squared.
Yeah, I think that's right.
N squared generations in this one here.
I think that's right.
So then you're looking at it like a diffusion process. You've squashed up time and. Yep.
And then they converge to the same diffusion process. Yeah. So,
So there are these two models with replacement and without replacement. Do the properties depend on this?
Well, if you did things without replacement, well, I mean, look at this one. It's sort of easiest. If you did it strictly without replacement, you end up with a thing that looks like this, right? And you never lose variation, and you eventually everybody is different and continues to diverge, and it's not sort of a sensible model in some sense, right? So what this sampling with replacement does is it generates random drifts so that allele frequencies change with time. And this is one way of introducing that drift, and it has some precise, you make some precise assumption about it, and then you get these precise predictions. But it's not as if we really believe this is exactly the way it works in the real world, but it's a representation that has some connection to, you know, it introduces this kind of random sampling in a way that's...
But in the Moran model, it would seem like only one over n effect, and if you just dump the replacement, the log n limit wouldn't change.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if you... These two are the same individual, not. If you change the model slightly, it wouldn't make any difference in the limit.
Okay.
But there are some benefits of having it, that you can choose the same one to die as give it birth, because in some simple classes of models, the Moran model is reversible in time. There's a balanced equation, it's reversible. But the right fissure is never reversible. So so you can analyze it nicely. Sometimes we can't know for sure.
Right.
There's no correlation between successive time steps.
That's correct. That's important in both these. That's right. Yeah.
Another question. Can you clarify, order of limits? So you have a n size of a system, then you have number of steps, and then you have a size of a sample.
Right.
Right, so there are three different
numbers. Yep.
What thermodynamic limit or limit of large n, so what do you mean exactly? First to infinity, second and third.
What I'm going to suggest is that it might be actually clearer as I get a little farther on when I actually derive some results, and you'll kind of see how this n, big N, comes into it, and a little bit about how the sample size down here comes into it, and it might be easier to answer, and maybe clear enough that you don't even bother to answer. So I'm going to getting through about 1/10 of what I thought we might do. But I think it's I'm happy enough about it. I don't have any, and I'll have some opportunity.
Is a way we can declare a brief moratorium on the questions.
Yeah, well, it's not just that. I mean, yeah.
About half an hour and then the salt.
I'm happy with the questions.
You can do the call, isn't now that too many questions.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so we'll see still. I'm happy for any leaders to press it in any particular scheme, but let me... So what I want to be able to do is get some sense of what I expect in the kind of data set that I talked about, that original data, when the model is of that kind that I've described there. So what should I say? And I'm going to start out with my data set being a much smaller one than what I described, namely just two. Sample size 2. So suppose I sample these two sequences, two copies, and what can I say about this? The only descriptive statistic I have is sort of how many differences there are between the two. And that's all there's sort of left in this data set, if I just have two. And the way I'm going to, there's quite a few ways to sort of derive something about that, but I'm going to think about it in the following way. So let me represent again this offspring population that has 2n copies in it, but I have just two that I've randomly selected from the population. And this is an offspring. This is like the current population, and I'm going to start thinking about the parents. And under the model that I described, if these two are the ones that I sampled, if I look at the parents of this population and focus on, in particular, the parents of these two, this in the parental population, the parent of this individual is equally likely to be any of these 2n copies up here, and so I'm going to draw a line. Say, okay, that's the parent of that one. Now, this is crucial that this is neutral now, and that's why any of these are equally likely to be the parent. If I had some selective differences here, certain individuals are more likely to be parents than others. And I'm not assuming I'm not thinking about what the pattern of variation is down here at this point. I'm just thinking of this parental, of this genealogical relationship. This individual has a parent up here, randomly chosen from all 2n, and is completely independent of what one I picked for this one. So in fact, it has some small probability of having exactly the same parent as that, but a much larger probability near one of being a different one. And so the crucial observation is the probability that these two things have a common ancestor in the previous generation is, under the model that I've assumed over there, just 1/2n. And that's, everything almost follows once you believe that's true. The probability to have distinct ancestors, probability of distinct ancestors in the previous generation is 1 - 1/2n. And if you believe that if they do have distinct ancestors here, that the probability of the next generation they also have distinct ancestors is independent, I mean, we assumption it's independent, then the probability they have distinct ancestors one generation back and the next generation back is just this quantity squared, etc. So the history then goes back many generations, and eventually you get a common ancestor event, and the probability that time to the most recent common ancestor equals, say, j generations is 1 - 1/2n, to the j minus 1 times the 1 over 2n. Okay? So that these things I've written down describe the statistical properties of the ancestry of these two sampled things, and it's sort of a complete description under this model of everything we want to know about this sample in a way. Except now it turns out, if we think about the mutation process that we had, every single generation was a mean mu mutations added in, and in each generation we assume that that goes on and it's independent in every generation, then the number of mutations that we expect that distinguish these two would be just a Poisson with mean equal to conditional on the time, would be 2 mu times that time in generation. Everybody buy that? So conditional on this, on the value of this number of generations, the number of differences here is Poisson distributed. But of course, this genealogy is a stochastic thing, is a probabilistic thing itself. So to get the distribution of the number of differences, so expected number of differences conditional on the value of this thing, it's just 2 mu, what I wrote down there. But we really like to take away this conditioning, and this time, as I've described it here, is just geometrically distributed, and so you can do the compound distribution quite easily. And I'll write it down in a second, but before I did that, I wanted to point out that in a large population, we typically just approximate that by an exponential distribution, where the mean of the exponential is 2n generations. So the mean time back to the common ancestor is 2n generations. And as I say, we usually approximate this distribution here, this geometric with an exponential for large populations. And so if you take this to be an exponential the geometric, either one, you can get the unconditional distribution of this. And it turns out that the probability that the number of differences, I'm going to call it pi 1, 2, equals, should I use J? No, not J, I'll use another one. Equals, okay, is, so it turns out when you do this compound distribution to incorporate the distribution of this time, you get this. And I'll describe how you can sort of get that directly without doing that, doing any integral or sum. Let me describe that now. So this parameter, oh, I didn't say it. This parameter theta is 4n. So I'll show you how you arrive at that. And the expected number of differences is just 2 mu times the expected value of that, which I said a minute ago was 2n generations. Which I'm calling theta. So the expected number of differences is this 4nu, and the distribution is given by this. And if you do this, if you think of it as a large population and you sort of go over to a continuous kind of model for this thing, instead of thinking of generations as discrete things, you think of it as a continuous time thing, you can sort of think of it as every little unit of time. Well, the other thing I should say is that oftentimes people move to a time scaled by 2n or 4n or something, and then the results all look independent of n, but it's hidden in the scaling of n. But the results are sort of the same. So if you measure time in this thing in units of 2n generations, the average time back is 1 in those time units. And so that's a common ploy to use. But one way of thinking about this process, and it sort of generalizes to a lot of other aspects of this model is that I think of this as sort of tracing back the ancestor of these sampled chromosomes. And as I say, I think of it in a continuous time frame right now instead of these discrete generations I'm thinking of. And there's sort of a rate process for mutation that this one's mutating per unit time rate mu, this one's mutating per unit time at rate u, and there's a probability per unit time of coalescing of probably 1 over 2n per unit time, not in the scale time, but in this generation time. And so the probability, okay, so I'm going to exploit this in a second, but I forgot to introduce one other result, and that is, what's the probability that that this pi 1 2 equals zero? That turns out to be this. Okay, so what I'm going to do is use this thinking to get that, and then then it'll be obvious how this result comes from the same thing. So what's the probability that you have no differences? As well, it's the probability that you're tracing back these two lineages, that the first event you encounter of mutation or common ancestor event is a common ancestor event. So if you're tracing back these histories and you find that there's been a mutation event in one of them, these two things are necessarily different. If you trace back and you get a mutation over here, these two things are necessarily different. If you trace them back and before you get a mutation, you get a common ancestor event, these two things are necessarily identical. So if these quantities are all small, mu and 1 over 2n, really the probability of the first event is a common ancestor event. It's just the rate for that over the sum of the rates of the processes, right? So this is the probability that as you're tracing back these things, then you think you have a chance of either encountering a mutation that happened in the history, or there's a chance that you have a common ancestor. You can think of them as sort of competing exponentials or something like that, and these are the rates for each of them. And then this is probably the first event back as a common ancestor, and that's just this quantity 1 over 1 plus theta that I've written right here. But you can also get it if you treat this as a distribution, and instead of moments, ask for probabilities, you can ask that you get the probability of getting a certain number of mutations is Poisson conditional on this time, and so you can do the integral of that and you get the same sort of thing. Now, the probability that there are k differences between these two sequences is that as you trace back here, the first event is a mutation, the second event is a mutation, the third event is a mutation until you get to k, and then the k plus first event is a common ancestor event. So that immediately leads to this. This is the probability of the first event is a mutation, second event is a mutation, third up to the kth, and then the kth plus first is that. So this way of sort of thinking about it leads sort of directly into that, to those results that you could get by considering this distribution of this time. So that this argument completely avoids explicitly writing down the time between these events and thinking about its distribution. It's just too. So that's that. Let me just give you a sort of a hint about now going to bigger sample sizes and what happens. And basically, the observation is, so now I've got three things that small n things that I sampled. Let me do small n. So I've sampled small n copies here. 1, 2, 3, n minus 1, n. So small n is my number of sampled copies in my data set, and I want to know about their history. Well, the probability that these small n copies all have distinct ancestors one generation earlier is the following. The product of those, right? So if I take my first one and I pick its ancestor randomly, then I pick the second one, pick it randomly, the probability it's distinct from that first one is 1 minus 1 over 2n. Then I pick my third one, the probability that its ancestor is distinct from both of them. So this quantity, I didn't write it down. There's a probability that all ancestors distinct in previous generation. Right? And it's just this simple product. And so that's that's the only kind of new thing you need, and now you can sort of do arbitrary sample sizes. The typical thing to do is assume this 2n is large, and then this looks like 1 minus n choose 2 over 2n plus an order 1 over n squared sort of terms, right? So you drop out all these higher order terms in n. But that's an approximation, and but this is typically what's done. So what this is, so that gives you the probability that they're all distinct. So the ancestry looks like generation of all distinct, generation of all distinct, generation of all distinct was just a product of these terms until finally they're not all distinct. Some one or more of them, of the lineages, coalesce to a common ancestor. And that happens with probability like this. So the ancestry then I'm tracing back these lineages of these n tips, and at a time, a random time that I might call t sub n, which is approximately distributed as an exponential, would mean 2n over n choose 2. We get a common ancestor of some kind, and it could be between two of them, or it could be with the most likely thing is when you do get an event, it's that two of these lineages have a common ancestor. But these other terms in here include the possibility of three things coming together at once, or four things coming together at once, or two different pairs coming together or something. Basically, what we typically do, assume we have a large population, and we ignore this, and assume that the next event looks like that. And then, the next sort of conceptual element that's, you know, maybe not the first person who thought about this maybe had to think about a little while, is that the history above here is identical to what we were just describing, but with n minus 1 tips instead of n, right? So we started with n, and now at this event, at this random point in time, we've got n minus 1 lineages that are now being tracked back in time, and the time until they would coalesce would be an independent exponential, the only thing being different being there's an n minus 1 here. And so the history goes back, and then you pick under our model, which two lineages coalesce could involve this one or it might not. So the next event back might look like that. And now we have n minus 2 lineages. And so the genealogy, the statistical properties of the genealogy of a small sample down in here under this model, there are approximations involved, of course, is that these time intervals during which you have a certain number of ancestral lineages are these simple, the parameters of the exponentials like this. The time interval between them are independent exponentials, but with different means. And the structure of the tree is this random pairing of lineages. So so that's kind of a description of a kind of stochastic process that would generate a genealogy. And from that description, it's pretty easy to derive quite a few properties of the variation that you get down here. And I don't know, we need to get out here in 8 minutes or something in front of my watch, right? So I can describe a couple of simple properties you can get but there's not much else I can do right now. So it turns out, for example, if I draw this tree on out here. Now, I guess one thing I should say is that if a population, to get back to your question, if a population was established, say, with no variation at a certain point in the past, you know, maybe it was founded by a single copy and then all the descendants are descendants from that single copy, you'd hit a boundary up here, right, where you have your initial conditions or something. And so if you assume the population was founded and instantaneously grew to population size big N and did this process, you could do everything from here until you hit that, and then everything should come together at one point. So there's a time, in order to have the properties I described hold, you have to have enough time for all this to go on without hitting the end of that. The other thing is that the error we make and this kind of thing here is related to that this sample size be small compared to this, the whole population size. So there's some approximation there that ignoring these multiple coalescent events and stuff is the error I'm making in making that assumption is related to this small n being a lot less than this big n. And there are some interesting problems in thinking about the entire population being sampled or something like that. There's some very interesting problems there. But let me just give you a couple of results about this thing. For example, the expected time to the most recent common ancestor of the whole sample for a sample size small n is just 4n times 1 minus 1 over small n. Okay, so that's the expected time back to the common ancestor of the entire sample. So that very quickly approaches 4n. For a sample of size 2, it's just 2n. So this upper part of this last coalescent event takes on average roughly half the entire duration of this thing. The variances of these things are like the square, you know, they're exponential time, so they have large variances, modes at zero, et cetera. So that's relevant. The other quantity that's often of interest is what I might call T total, which is the sum of the lengths of all the branches. So that length of that plus that plus that plus that plus that plus that. The lengths of all those branches, which are just this interval times small n plus this next interval times small n minus 1, next interval n minus 3, etc. That time, the expectation of that is 4n times sum 1 over j. J equals 1 to n minus 1. So that grows roughly logarithmically with the sample size. So as you get, as this small n gets bigger and bigger, the total size of that tree, sum of all lengths of the branches, grows indefinitely but slowly. And one of the reasons this is of interest is that the expected number of polymorphic sites in our sample is just mu times this quantity here. So it's just theta times sum 1 over j. So this is the expected number of polymorphic sites. We have in our data set, we have an observed number of polymorphic sites. And a common thing to do is to estimate this parameter theta by that number of polymorphic sites divided by this summation. This is called Watterson's estimate of theta. And Watterson was the first one to obtained this relationship, and he didn't explicitly write down that we would estimate theta, but everybody, as soon as we started to get data, started estimating theta in this way, and so this is called Watterson's estimate. Now, for a sample size 2, remember we saw that the expected number of differences between two copies was theta. So another way of estimating theta was to take the average of all these pairwise comparisons between the sequences in the sample. So I take that divided by n choose 2, and that's an estimate of theta. What's that? Usually called theta pi, I think, something like that. So this uses just doing all the pairwise comparisons, taking the average number of differences, and that gives you an estimate of theta. Or one takes the total number of polymorphic sites, divides by the sum, and that gives you an estimate of theta under this model. So, and under this model with no structure, no recombination, no selection, constant population size, it's about what you can do is estimate that parameter. But people have devised statistical tests, and I don't have time to do, but that might be, Marty's going to talk a bunch about statistical tests maybe on Monday or something. But actually one statistical test that people do of neutrality is compare this estimate of theta to this estimate of theta. And if the neutral model is right, the expectation of the difference between those two is zero. So there's a thing called Tajima's D where you take the difference and normalize it by quantity, and it has roughly a mean zero under the neutral model and variance one, the way it's normalized. And they use that as a test statistic, and if it seems unusually large, they say it looks like this data is not compatible with neutrality. And there's a lot of alternative models where you can show that quantity of the difference between these two would be shifted in one direction or another, and so the data is often interpreted by, as I say, calculating this test statistic involving the difference between these two. Turns out this statistic is very sensitive to the frequencies of, say, the derived alleles. So if you had one sample that had 10 polymorphic sites and the derived allele was always at frequency 1 out of your sample, you get a very low value of this pi. Whereas if the allele frequencies were near n over 2, you get a much higher value of this statistic. So you get departures under this test if the allele frequencies are very close to n over 2 or mostly single, what we call singletons or doubletons, very low frequency, then this test statistic will flag that pattern of polymorphism as being kind of unusual under the neutral model. Mm-hmm. So,
Is that test sensitive to changes in the population size?
Absolutely, yeah. So that's one of the ways, one of the typical interpretations of that test is, oh, I've had a recent population expansion, or I've had a bottleneck recently, and it's caused these genealogies to be very different. It turns out this time scale here in the population size model, right, is all the expectations are proportional to 2n. And it turns out that if you consider populations where the history has smaller or larger sizes, that you can kind of think of them as generating them first under the constant model and then just transforming, just distorting them, stretching parts where the population size is high and compressing parts where the population size is low. So if you had, instead of the population size being constant at this point, farther in time, back in time, the population size was much, much smaller. Effectively, what that does is compress all this upper part down. And then the trees tend to look much more like this. Much closer, not having these long stretched out upper parts. And when you put mutations on this kind of a tree, many of them turn out to be singletons. The branches of the tree that lead to more than one descendant are short. And as a consequence, this quantity tends to be much smaller than that quantity. So recent population expansions lead to this statistic being skewed in one direction, and that's a... Now, another way in which this can happen is that there was a site somewhere near or in the region that was selected and was driven to fixation recently rapidly, and that can have a similar kind of effect on things, and you can get this kind of genealogy there. So it's sort of a perennial problem in population genetics. Somebody will suggest some test that they think is, tests a certain kind of selection, and then someone will say, well, there's a demographic history that generates that similar pattern. But there are ways around that. I mean, particularly as data sets have gotten bigger and we have multiple loci, if it's demographic, you expect this thing to have happened across the genome to all the loci. But if it's a selective event, most of the loci won't have had that pattern. And so anyway, that's one of the ways in which one goes about it. But we're past time already, so.
Yeah, in this case, with humans, but Arabidopsis, I was about to say, but we did sequence about 1,000 of these little loci. And the distribution of these digimon Ds for those individual loci was decidedly negative with a kind of mean of the distribution, I can't remember, minus 1.6 or minus 2 or something like that. But you can see the whole distribution was very much skewed. So it's very clear that there was some common
demographic effect. Or something that influences something. Large fraction of
the
loci.
Yeah.
So suppose I'll do the following test. There's a question to the kind of extension of a type of questions which you've been asking. So I have this model. I accept one of those models. And then I start from mu, mutation rate, which I know.
Okay.
Then I do reconstruction, right? And I study, I introduce kind of notion of error rate. How different are those two? original and what you measure. In the process of reconstruction, with whatever criterion you use for reconstruction. And then I study how it depends on the ratio of my sample size to population size. Do I expect any kind of phase transition, qualitative change in behavior? Like when size would be very small, I cannot reconstruct anything, and then all of a sudden, I'll get a sharp transition. So is that the right type of picture for this model or not?
I guess what I'm a little uncertain about is what you refer to as the reconstruction.
Whenever you have original theta.
Yeah.
And actual theta measured in one of those.
Yeah. Okay.
Ways.
So you think you.
Well, let's introduce one kind of threshold.
Yeah.
The same within certain margin. You call it, good reconstruction.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you call it bad reconstruction.
Yeah.
And. So you ask statistically how
many
events.
Well, it's definitely the case that under a lot of alternative models, so we have this null neutral model, everything very, very simple. You look at some alternative models where the population size has changed or selection has had an effect or something, your ability to detect that can be very sensitive to your population, to your sample size, this small sample size thing. And I don't know whether there's a phase transition, but there's a monotonic increase, presumably, if you do almost any kind of analysis in your power to detect that alternative model. And some models, it's more so than others. I mean, you just can't detect these kind of bottlenecks if you have a sample size of 5, but if you do 200, the difference between these will become very dramatic. But I don't think that's really getting at your question, I'm afraid. Yeah, so there's definitely a sensitivity to this sample size in your power to.
But you don't know if it is sharp transition. Would it be an interesting thing to study?
I don't think there's any phase transition. No, I doubt it.
In practice,
it's not like percolation or something.
Is there a minimum sample size you would take seriously?
Well, it really depends on the details of the alternative model that you have in mind, I think. One of the things that's remarkable is when people estimate this theta this way, it's been shown that if you believe this mutation rate per base pair is fairly uniform over a lot of the genome, that you get a whole lot more information that narrows this down by doing more rather than doing more than 5 or 10 samples. I mean, if you have small n equals to 10, you just don't gain much by getting more. But that's just for the issue of estimating this theta quantity. If you go to testing for the presence of some bottleneck in the past, that depends on seeing these lower frequency variants being overrepresented in your sample, and bigger samples are much more powerful. So it really, it's hard. I don't think there's any generalization you can make. But people have made the observation that if you're just interested in this parameter here, you shouldn't get a big sample.
Okay, I think we have to start learning more. Thanks.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.